chest. You took it? My hands fell uselessly to my sides. I took it the night of your party. I shook my head. It was a stupid thing to do. I'm so sorry.
Did you read it? She demanded.
No.
You liar, she sneered. You read it, didn't you? Who wouldn't? I hate you. Is your life so boring that you have to go snooping through mine? Did you read the whole thing or just the parts about you?
I was on the verge of adamantly denying even opening it when Marcy's words caused my thoughts to catch and rewind.
Me? What did you write about me?
She flung the diary onto the porch behind her, then straightened up, squaring her shoulders.
What do I care? She said, crossing her arms and glaring at me. Now you know the truth. How does it feel knowing your mom is screwing other people's husbands?
I gave a disbelieving laugh that held more than its share of anger.
Excuse me? You really think your mom is out of town all those nights? Ha! Huh.
I adopted Marcy's posture. Actually, I do. What was she insinuating?
Then how do you explain why her car is parked down the street one night a week?
You have the wrong person, I said, feeling my rage boil up. I was pretty sure I now knew exactly what Marcy was getting at. How dare she accuse my mom of having an affair? And with her dad, of all people? If he was the last man on the planet, my mom wouldn't be caught dead with him. I hated Marcy, and my mom knew it. She wasn't sleeping with Marcy's father. She would never do that to me. She would never do that to my dad. Never.
Beige Taurus, license plate X4I24.
Marcy's voice was arctic. So you know her license plate number, I said after a moment, trying to ignore the tightening sensation in my chest. That doesn't prove anything.
Wake up, Nora. Our parents knew each other in high school. Your mom and my dad, they were together.
I shook my head. That's a lie. My mom has never said anything about your dad.
Because she doesn't want you to know.
Her eyes flashed.
Because she's still with him. He is her dirty little secret.
I shook my head harder, feeling like a broken doll. Maybe my mom knew your dad in high school, but that was a long time ago, before she met my dad. You have the wrong person. You saw someone else's car parked down the street. When she's not home, she's out of town, working.
I saw them together, Nora. It was your mom, so don't even try to make excuses for her. I went to school that day and spray-painted your locker with a message to your mom. Don't you get it?
Her voice was a revolted hiss.
They were sleeping together. All these years they've been doing it, which means my dad could be your dad, and you could be my sister.
Marcy's words dropped like a blade between us. I hugged my arms around my middle and turned away, feeling like I might be sick. Tears choked up my throat, burning the back of my nose. Without a word, I walked stiffly down Marcy's walk. I thought she might shout something worse at my back, but there was nothing worse she could say. I didn't go to Patches. I must have walked all the way back to Clementine, past the bus stop, the park, and the city swimming pool, because the next thing I remembered, I was sitting on a bench on the lawn in front of the public library. A cone of streetlight fell over me. It was a warm night, but I hugged my knees against my chest, my body racked with tremors. My thoughts were a jumble of haunting theories. I stared into the darkness settling around me. Headlights swung down the street, grew closer, moved on. Sporadic sitcom laughter carried out an open window across the street. Pockets of cool air flushed goosebumps across my arms. The heady smell of grass, musky and humid from the earlier sun, suffocated me. I lay back on the bench, shutting my eyes against the dusting of stars. I laced my quivering hands on my stomach, my fingers feeling like frozen twigs. I wondered why life had to suck so hard sometimes. Wondered why it was the people I loved the most who could disappoint me the hardest. Wondered who I wanted to direct my hate at more. Marcy, her dad, or my mom. Deep inside, I clung to the hope that Marcy was wrong. I hoped I'd get to fling this back in her face. But the sinking sensation that seemed to tug me inside out told me I was only setting myself up for disappointment. I couldn't pinpoint the memory, but it was within the last year or so. Maybe shortly before my dad died. No, after. It had been a warm day, spring. The funeral was over, my grace period of grieving had ended, and I was back in school. V had talked me into ditching class, and in those days I didn't offer much resistance to anything. I floated along. I got by. On the thought that my mom would be at work, we'd walked to my house. It must have taken us all of 7th hour to get there. As the farmhouse came into view, V yanked me off the road.
There's a car in your driveway, she said.
Whose could it be? Looks like a Land Cruiser.
Your mom doesn't drive one of those.
Do you think it's a detective? It wasn't likely that a detective would be driving a $60,000 SUV, but I was so used to detectives stopping by, it was the first thought that came to mind.
Let's get closer.
We were almost to the driveway when the front door opened and voices carried out. My mom's, and a deeper voice, a man's. V lugged me to the side of the house, out of sight. We watched as Hank Miller climbed into the Land Cruiser and drove away.
Holy freak show, V said. Normally I'd suspect foul play, but your mom is as straight-laced as they come. I bet he was trying to sell her a car.
He came all this way for that?
Heck yeah, babe. Car salesmen don't know where to draw the line.
She already has a car.
A Ford? That's like Toyota's worst enemy. Marcy's dad won't be happy until the whole town is driving a Toyota.
I strayed out of the memory. But what if he hadn't been selling her a car? What if they'd... I swallowed involuntarily. Been having an affair. Where was I supposed to go now? Home? The farmhouse no longer felt like home. It no longer felt safe and secure. It felt like a box of lies. My parents had sold me a story about love, togetherness, and family. But if Marcy was telling the truth, and my greatest fear was that she was, my family was a joke. A big lie I'd never even seen coming. Shouldn't there have been warning signs? Shouldn't I have been hit with the realization that I'd secretly suspected this all along, but had chosen denial over the painful truth? This was my punishment for trusting others. This was my punishment for looking for the good in people. As much as I hated Patch right now, I envied the cold detachment that separated him from everyone else. He suspected the worst in people. No matter how low they sank, he always saw it coming. He was hardened and worldly, but people respected him for it. They respected him, and they lied to me. I swung upright on the bench and punched my mom's number into my cell. I didn't know what I'd say when she answered. I'd let my anger and betrayal guide me. While her phone rang, hot tears tumbled down my cheeks. I slapped them away. My chin trembled, and every muscle in my body was drawn taut. Angry, spiteful words sprang to mind. I envisioned shouting them at her, cutting her off every time she tried to defend herself with more lies. And if she cried, I wouldn't feel sorry. She deserved to feel every last ounce of pain from the choices she'd made. Her voicemail picked up, and it was all I could do to keep from flinging the phone into the darkness. I dialed V next.
Yo, babe, is this important? I'm with Rickson.
I'm leaving home, I said, not caring that my voice sounded thick from crying. Can I stay at your house for a while? Until I figure out where I'm going?
V's breathing filled my ear. Say what?
My mom gets home on Saturday. I want to be gone by then. Can I stay with you the rest of the week?
Can I ask?
No.
Okay, sure, V said, trying to hide her shock.
You can stay, no problem.
No problem at all.
You'll tell me what's up when you're ready. I felt fresh tears well up inside me. Right now, V was the only person I could count on. She could be obnoxious, annoying, and lazy, but she never lied to me. I got to the farmhouse around 9 and slipped into a pair of cotton PJs. It wasn't a cold night, but the air was humid and the moisture seemed to slip beneath my skin, chilling me to the bone. After making myself a cup of steamed milk, I sank into bed. It was too early for sleep, but I couldn't have slept if I'd tried. My thoughts were still dashing themselves to pieces. I stared at the ceiling, trying to erase the last 16 years and start fresh. Hard as I might, I couldn't envision Hank Miller as my father. I swung out of bed and marched down the hall to my mom's bedroom. I flung open her hope chest, searching for her high school yearbook. I didn't even know if she owned one, but if she did, the hope chest was the only place I could think to look. If she and Hank Miller went to school together, there would be pictures. If they'd been in love, he would have signed her yearbook in some special way that would signify it. 5 minutes later, I'd thoroughly searched the chest and come up empty-handed. I padded to the kitchen, looked through the cupboards for something to eat, but found my appetite gone. I couldn't eat thinking about the big lie my family had turned out to be. I found my eyes traveling to the front door, but where would I go? I felt lost in the house, restless to leave, but with nowhere to run. After standing in the hallway for several minutes, I climbed back to my bedroom. Lying in bed with the covers pulled up to my chin, I shut my eyes and watched a reel of pictures slide across my mind. Pictures of Marcy, of Hank Miller, whom I barely knew, and whose face I could conjure up only with difficulty, of my parents. Faster and faster the images came until they blended together in a strange collage of madness. The images seemed to lurch into reverse suddenly, traveling backward through time. All color drained from the reel until there was nothing but fuzzy black and white. It was then that I knew I'd slipped into the other realm. I was dreaming. I was standing in the front yard. A rowdy wind swept dead leaves across the driveway, around my ankles. An odd funnel cloud swirled in the sky overhead, but made no move to touch down, as if it was content to bide its time before striking. Patch was sitting on the porch rail, head bowed, hands clasped loosely between his knees. "Get out of my dream!" I hollered at him over the wind. He shook his head. "Not until I tell you what's going on." I pulled my pajama top tighter. "I don't want to hear what you have to say." "The archangels can't hear us here." I gave an accusatory laugh. "It wasn't enough manipulating me in real life. Now you have to do it here, too?" He lifted his head. "Manipulating? I'm trying to tell you what's going on." "You're forcing your way inside my dreams," I challenged. "You did it after the devil's handbag, and you're doing it now." A sudden gust of wind blew between us, causing me to take a step back. The tree branches creaked and moaned. I untangled my hair from my face. Patch said, "After the Z, in the Jeep, you told me you'd had a dream about Marcy's dad. The night you had the dream, I was thinking about him. I was remembering the exact memory you dreamed about, wishing there was some way I could tell you the truth. I didn't know I was communicating with you."
"You made me have that dream?"
"Not a dream. A memory."
I tried to digest this. If the dream was real, Hank Miller had been living in England hundreds of years ago. My memory spun back to the dream. "Tell the barkeep to send help," Hank had said. "Tell him there is no man. Tell him it is one of the devil's angels come to possess my body and cast away my soul." Was Hank Miller Nephilim?
"I don't know how I overlapped your dreams," Patch said, "but I've been trying to communicate with you the same way ever since. I got through the night I kissed you after the devil's handbag, but now I keep hitting walls. I'm lucky I'm here now. I think it's you. You're not letting me in."
"Because I don't want you inside my head."
He slid off the railing, coming down to meet me in the yard. "I need you to let me in." I turned away. "I was reassigned to Marcy," he said. 5 seconds passed before everything fell into place. The sick, hot feeling that had churned in my stomach since leaving Marcy's spread to my extremities.
"You're Marcy's guardian angel?"
"It hasn't been a pleasure cruise."
"Did the archangels do this?"
"When they assigned me as your guardian, they made it clear I was supposed to have your best interests in mind. Getting involved with you wasn't in your best interest. I knew it, but I didn't like the idea of the archangels telling me what to do with my personal life. They were watching us the night you gave me your ring."
"In the Jeep, the night before we broke up," I remembered.
"As soon as I realized they were watching us, I took off, but the damage was done. They told me I'd be out as soon as they found a replacement. Then they assigned me to Marcy. I went to her house that night to force myself to face what I'd done."
"Why Marcy?" I asked bitterly. "To punish me?"
He dragged a hand down over his mouth. "Marcy's dad is a first-generation Nephilim, a purebred. Now that Marcy is 16, she's in danger of being sacrificed. 2 months ago, when I tried to sacrifice you to get a human body, but ended up saving your life, there weren't many fallen angels who believed they could change what they were. I'm a guardian now. They all know it, and they all know it's because I saved you from dying. Suddenly, a lot more of them believe they can cheat fate, too, either by saving a human and getting their wings back," he exhaled, "or by killing their Nephil vassal and transforming their body from fallen angel to human."
I reviewed in my mind everything I knew about fallen angels and Nephilim. The Book of Enoch told of a fallen angel who became human after killing his Nephil vassal by sacrificing one of the vassal's female descendants. 2 months ago, Patch had attempted this very thing by intending to use me to kill Chauncey. Now, if the fallen angel who'd forced Hank Miller to swear fealty wanted to become human, well, he'd have to sacrifice Marcy. I said,
You mean it's your job to make sure the fallen angel who forced Hank Miller to swear fealty doesn't sacrifice Marcy to get a human body? As if he thought he knew me well enough to guess my next question, he said, Marcy doesn't know. She's completely in the dark. I didn't want to talk about this. I didn't want Patch here. He'd killed my dad. He'd ripped away forever someone I loved. Patch was a monster. Nothing he could say could make me feel otherwise. Chauncey formed the Nephilim Blood Society, Patch said. My attention snapped back. What? How do you know? He looked reluctant to answer.
I've accessed a few memories. Other people's memories.
Other people's memories? I was shocked when I shouldn't have been. How could he justify all the horrible things he'd done? How could he come here and tell me he'd secretly examined people's most private and intimate thoughts and expect me to admire him for it? Or even expect me to listen to him?
A successor picked up where Chauncey left off. I haven't been able to get a name yet, but rumor has it he isn't happy about Chauncey's death. Which doesn't make sense. He's in charge now. That alone should have wiped away any remorse he felt over Chauncey's death. Which makes me wonder if the successor was a close friend of Chauncey's, or a relative.
I shook my head. I don't want to hear this.
The successor has a contract out on Chauncey's killer.
Any further protesting on my part died forming. Patch and I shared a look.
He wants the killer to pay.
You mean he wants me to pay? I said, my voice barely pushing through.
Nobody knows you killed Chauncey. He didn't know you were his female descendant until moments before he died, so there's little chance anyone else knew. Chauncey's successor might try to track down Chauncey's descendants, but I wish him luck. It took me a long time to find you.
He took a step toward me, but I backed up.
When you wake up, I need you to say you want me as your guardian angel again. Say it like you mean it, so the archangels hear it and hopefully grant your request. I'm doing everything I can to keep you safe, but I'm restricted. I need heightened access to the people around you, your emotions, everything in your world.
What was he saying? That the archangels had finally found my replacement guardian angel? Was this why he'd forced his way inside my dream tonight? Because he'd been cut off and no longer had the access to me that he wanted? I felt his hands slide to my hips, holding me protectively against him.
I'm not going to let anything happen to you.
I stiffened and shrugged free. My mind was in a tempest. He wants the killer to pay. I couldn't shake off the thought. The idea that someone out there wanted to kill me was numbing. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to know these things. I wanted to feel safe again. Realizing that Patch had no intention of leaving my dream, I made my own move. I fought against the invisible barriers of my dream by forcing myself awake. Open your eyes, I told myself. Open them. Patch gripped my elbow.
What are you doing?
I could feel myself becoming more lucid. I could feel the warmth of my sheets, my pillowcase soft against my cheek. All the familiar smells associated with my room comforted me.
Don't wake up, Angel.
He smoothed his hands against my hair, trapping my face, forcing me to look him in the eye.
There's more you need to know. There's a very important reason why you need to see these memories. I'm trying to tell you something that I can't tell you any other way. I need you to figure out what I'm trying to tell you. I need you to stop blocking me.
I jerked my face away. My feet seemed to rise up from the grass, drifting toward the stirring funnel cloud. Patch grabbed for me, swearing under his breath, but his hold on me was feather-light, imaginary. Wake up, I ordered myself. Wake up. I let the cloud consume me. Chapter 18. I woke up with a sharp intake of air. My room was settled in shadow, the moon glowing like a crystal ball on the far side of the window. My sheets were hot and damp, tangled around my legs. The clock read 9:30. I flung myself out of bed and went to the bathroom, filling a cold glass of water. I gulped it down, then leaned against the wall. I couldn't fall back asleep. Whatever I did, I couldn't let Patch back in my dreams. I paced the upstairs hall, frantically trying to keep myself wide awake, but I was so worked up, I doubted I could have slept if I'd wanted to. Several minutes later, the throb of my pulse had died down, but my mind wasn't as easy to settle. The Black Hand. Those three words haunted me. They were elusive, menacing, taunting. I couldn't bring myself to look them straight on. Not without feeling my already flimsy world start to shatter.
I knew I was avoiding finding a way to let the Archangels know Patch was the Black Hand and my father's killer, to protect myself from the shameful truth. I'd fallen in love with a killer. I'd let him kiss me, lie to me, betray me. When he touched me in my dreams, all my strength crumbled, and I felt myself being tangled up in his net all over again. He still held my heart in his hand, and that was the biggest betrayal of all. What kind of person was I when I couldn't bring my own father's killer to justice? Patch had said I could tell the Archangels I wanted him as my guardian angel again through the simple act of saying it out loud. It seemed logical then that I could shout out, "Patch killed my dad," and be done with it. Justice would be served. Patch would be sent to hell, and I could slowly start to rebuild my life. But I couldn't pull the words up, as if they were chained down someplace deep inside me. Too many things weren't adding up. Why was Patch, an angel, mixed up with a Nephilim blood society? If he was the Black Hand, why was he branding Nephilim recruits? Why was he recruiting them in the first place? It wasn't just odd, it was illogical. The Nephilim race hated angels, and vice versa. And if the Black Hand was Chauncey's successor and the new leader of the society, how could that person possibly be Patch? I squeezed the bridge of my nose, feeling like my head might crack from chasing the same questions over and over. Why was it that everything surrounding the Black Hand seemed to be an endless maze of trapdoor after trapdoor after trapdoor? Right now, Scott was my only reliable link left to the Black Hand. He knew more than he was letting on, I was sure of it, but he was too scared to talk. The tone of his voice when he'd spoken of the Black Hand carried sheer panic. I needed him to tell me what he knew, but he was running from his past, and nothing I said was going to make him turn back and face it. I pressed my forehead into the palms of my hands, trying to think clearly. I called V.
"Good news," she said before I could get a word in edgewise. "I talked my dad into driving back to the beach with me and paying the fine to get the boot off my car. I am back in business."
"Good, because I need your help."
"Help is my middle name."
I was pretty sure she'd already told me Bad was her middle name, but I kept my opinion to myself. I need someone to help me look through Scott's bedroom. Chances were Scott wasn't going to keep any evidence detailing his involvement with the Nephilim Blood Society out in the open. But what alternative did I have? He had done a terrific job of not giving me direct answers in the past, and after our last encounter, I knew he was wary of me. If I wanted to find out what he knew, I was going to have to do a little legwork.
"Apparently Patch canceled our double date, so my schedule is wide open," V said a little too eagerly. I'd expected her to ask what we were snooping for in Scott's bedroom.
"Going through Scott's bedroom isn't going to be dangerous or exciting," I told her, just to make sure we were both on the same page. "All you're going to do is sit in the neon outside his apartment and call me if you see him coming home. I'm the one who's going inside."
"Just because I'm not doing the spying doesn't mean it's not exciting. It'll be like watching a movie. Only in the movies, the good guy almost never gets caught. But this is real life, and there's a strong chance you'll get caught. See what I mean? The excitement factor is through the roof."
Personally, I thought V was a little over-anxious to see me caught.
"You are going to warn me if Scott comes home, right?" I asked. "Heck yeah, babe. I've got you covered."
My next call was to Scott's home line. Mrs. Parnell picked up.
"Nora, so good to hear your voice. Scott tells me things have been heating up between the two of you," she added in a conspirator's voice.
I always thought it would be real nice if Scott married a local girl. I don't much like the idea of him marrying into a family of strangers. What if his in-laws are nutcases? Your mom and I are such close friends. Can you imagine the fun we'd have planning a wedding together? But I'm getting ahead of myself, all in good time, as they say.
Oh, boy. "Is Scott there, Mrs. Parnell? I have some news I think he'll be interested in." I heard her cup a hand over the mouthpiece and shout,
"Scott, pick up the phone. It's Nora."
A moment later, Scott came on.
"You can hang up now, Mom."
His voice held a drop of wariness.
"Just making sure you got it, hun."
"I've got it."
"Nora has some interesting news," she said.
"Then hang up so she can tell me."
There was a sigh of disappointment and a click.
"I thought I told you to stay away from me," Scott said.
"Have you found a band yet?" I asked, pushing forward, hoping to take control of the conversation and pique his interest before he hung up on me.
"No,"
he said with that same guarded skepticism. I mentioned to a friend that you play the guitar.
I play bass.
And he spread the word and found a band that wants to audition you. Tonight.
What's the name of the band?
I hadn't anticipated that question. The Pigmen.
Sounds like something out of 1960.
Do you want the audition or not?
What time?
10, at the Devil's Handbag. If I'd known of a warehouse farther away, I would have mentioned it. As it was, I would have to make do with the 20 minutes it would take him to drive round trip.
I'll need a contact name and number.
He definitely was not supposed to ask that. I said, I told my friend I'd pass the information along to you, but I didn't think to ask for names and numbers of the band members.
I'm not going to blow my night on an audition without first getting an idea of who these guys are, what style they play, and where they've gigged. Are they punk, indie pop, metal?
What are you?
Punk.
I'll get their numbers and call you right back. I disconnected from Scott and immediately dialed V. I told Scott I got him an audition with a band tonight, but he wants to know what kind of music the band plays and where they've played. If I give him your number, would you pretend to be the girlfriend of someone from the band? Just say you always answer your boyfriend's phone when he's practicing. Don't elaborate further. Stick to the facts. They're a punk band, they're the next big thing, and he'd be stupid not to audition.
I'm really starting to like all this spy work, V said. When my normal life gets boring, all I have to do is sidle up next to you.
I was sitting on the front porch with my knees tucked against my chest when V cruised up.
I think we should stop at Skippy's for hot dogs before we do this, she said when I swung in. I don't know what it is about hot dogs, but they're like an instant shot of courage. I feel like I can do anything after I've had a hot dog.
That's because you're high on all the toxins they pump inside those things.
Like I said, I think we should stop by Skippy's. I already had pasta for dinner.
Pasta isn't very filling.
Pasta is very filling.
Yeah, but not in the way mustard and relish are, V argued.
15 minutes later, we were leaving the drive-thru at Skippy's with 2 grilled hot dogs, 1 large carton of fries, and 2 strawberry milkshakes.
I hate this kind of food, I said, feeling grease seep through the wax paper-wrapped hot dog onto my hand.
It's unhealthy.
So is a relationship with Patch, but that didn't stop you.
I didn't respond. A quarter mile from Scott's complex, V steered to the side of the road. The biggest problem I foresaw was our location. Deacon Road dead-ended just past the complex. V and I were out in the open, and as soon as Scott drove past and saw V sitting in the neon, he'd know something was up. I hadn't been worried that he'd recognize her voice on the phone, but I was worried he'd remember her face. He'd seen us together on more than one occasion and had even seen us tailing him in the neon once. She was guilty by association.
You're going to have to drive off the road and park behind those bushes, I instructed V.
V leaned forward, peering into the darkness.
Is that a ditch between me and the bushes?
It's not very deep. Trust me, we'll clear it.
Looks deep to me. This is a neon we're talking about, not a Hummer.
The neon doesn't weigh very much. If we get stuck, I'll get out and push. V put the car in drive and hopped to the shoulder of the road, the sound of overgrown weeds dragging along the undercarriage.
More gas, I said, my teeth knocking together as we bounced over the rocky embankment.
The car tipped forward and raced into the ditch, and the front tires slammed to a stop, hitting bottom.
I don't think we're going to make it up, V said, feeding the neon more gas.
The tires spun but didn't find traction.
I need to approach this sucker from an angle.
She cranked the wheel a hard left and punched the gas again.
That's more like it, she said as the neon dug in and lurched forward.
Watch out for the rock, I began, but it was too late. V drove the neon straight over a large jutting rock half buried in the earth. She stomped on the brake and killed the engine. We got out and stared at the front left tire.
Something doesn't look right, V said. Is the tire supposed to look like that?
I banged my head against the nearest tree trunk.
So we've got a flat, V said. What now?
We stick to the plan. I'll search Scott's room and you'll keep a lookout. When I get back, you'll call Rickson.
And tell him what?
That we saw a deer and you swerved to miss it. That's when you ran the neon into the ditch and over a rock.
I like that story, said V. It makes me sound like an animal lover. Rickson will like that.
Any questions? I asked her.
Nope, I've got it. Call you as soon as Scott leaves the premises. Call you again if he comes back and warn you to get the heck out of there.
V dropped her eyes to my footwear. Are you going to scale the building and climb in through a window? Because you might have wanted to wear tennis shoes for that. Your ballet flats are cute, but not practical. I'm going in through the front door. What are you going to say to Scott's mom? It doesn't matter. She likes me. She'll let me walk right inside. I held out my hot dog, which had grown cold. Do you want this?
No way. You're going to need it. If anything bad happens, just take a bite. 10 seconds later, you'll feel all warm and happy inside.
I jogged the rest of the way down Deacon, veering off into the shadows of the trees as soon as I could make out a human form moving back and forth across the lighted windows of Scott's third-story apartment. From what I could tell, Mrs. Parnell was in the kitchen, moving between the fridge and the sink, most likely baking dessert or throwing together a snack. The light in Scott's bedroom was on, but the shades were drawn. The light blinked out, and a moment later Scott entered the kitchen and brushed a kiss on his mom's cheek. I stayed put, swatting mosquitoes for 5 minutes, before Scott walked out the front door carrying what looked like a guitar case. He stowed the case in the trunk of the Mustang and backed out of the parking space. A minute later, V's ringtone sounded in my pocket.
"The eagle has flown the nest," she said.
"I know," I said. "Stay where you are. I'm going in." I hiked up to the front door and rang the bell. The door opened, and as soon as Mrs. Parnell saw me, she broke into a wide smile.
"Nora,"
she said, grasping me good-naturedly by the shoulders. "You just missed Scott. He left to audition with the band. I can't tell you how much it means to him that you went to the trouble to set this up. He's going to knock the socks off the other band members. Just you wait and see." She pinched my cheek affectionately.
"Actually, Scott just called me. He left some of his sheet music here and asked if I could pick it up. He would have come back for it himself, but he didn't want to show up late to the audition and make a bad impression."
"Oh, yes, of course. Come right in. Did he say which music he wanted?"
"He texted me a couple of titles."
She drew the door all the way open. "I'll walk you back to his room. Scott will be so upset if the audition doesn't go just the way he wants. He's usually so particular about taking the right music, but it all happened on such short notice. I'm sure he's going out of his mind, poor thing."
"He sounded really upset," I agreed. "I'll hurry as fast as I can."
Mrs. Parnell led the way down the hall. As I stepped across the threshold into Scott's bedroom, I took in the complete change of scenery. The first thing I noticed was the black paint on the walls. They'd been white the last time I came over. The Godfather poster and the New England Patriots pennant had been ripped down. The air smelled heavily of paint and Febreze.
"You'll have to excuse the walls," Mrs. Parnell said. "Scott's been going through a bit of an emotional downturn. Moving can be hard. He needs to get out more."
She looked meaningfully at me. I pretended to miss the hint.
"So that's the sheet music?"
I asked, gesturing at a heap of paper on the floor. Mrs. Parnell wiped her hands on her apron.
"Do you want me to help you hunt down the titles?"
"It's no problem, really. I don't want to keep you. It'll just take me a second." As soon as she left, I closed the door. I set my cell and the Skippy's hot dog on the desk opposite the bed, then moved to the closet. A pair of white high tops stuck out from a mound of jeans and t-shirts on the floor. Only 3 lumberjack shirts were left on hangers. I wondered if Mrs. Parnell had bought them, because I couldn't picture Scott in flannel. Under the bed I found 1 aluminum bat, 1 baseball mitt, and 1 potted plant. I called V.
"What does marijuana look like?"
5 leaves," V said.
"Scott is growing marijuana in here, under his bed."
"Are you surprised?"
I wasn't, but it did explain the Febreze. I wasn't sure I could picture Scott smoking pot, but I wouldn't put him past selling it. He was desperate for cash.
"I'll call back if I find anything else," I said. I dropped my cell on Scott's bed and turned a slow circle around the room. There weren't many hiding places. The underside of the desk was clean. The heating vents were empty. Nothing was sewn into his blanket. I was about to give up when something high in the closet caught my eye. There was damage to the wall. I dragged the desk chair over and stepped up. A medium-sized square hole had been cut out of the wall, but the plaster had been replaced to make it appear as if the hole wasn't there. Using a wire hanger, I reached up as high as I could and knocked the square of plaster out. From what I could tell, an orange Nike shoebox was crammed into the space. I jabbed at it with the hanger, but ended up pushing it farther back. A soft buzzing sound broke my concentration, and I realized my cell was ringing on vibrate, the blankets on Scott's bed muffling the sound. I jumped down.
"V?" I answered.
"Get out of there!" she hissed in a panicked undertone. "Scott called again and asked for directions to the warehouse, but I didn't know which warehouse you told him." I sort of stalled and said I was only the girlfriend, and I didn't know where the band held its auditions. He asked which warehouse they practiced at, and I said I didn't know that either. The good news is he hung up, so I didn't have to lie my way into a bigger hole. The bad news is he's on his way home, right now.
How much time do I have?
Since he already flew past here at about 100 miles per hour, I'd guess a minute. Or less.
V!
Don't blame me. You're the one who wasn't answering your phone.
Chase him down and stall for time. I need 2 more minutes.
Chase him down? How? The neon has a flat.
With your own 2 feet.
You mean exercise?
Cradling the phone under my chin, I found a scrap of paper in my handbag and hunted through Scott's desk for a pen.
It's less than a fourth of a mile. That's 1 lap around the track. Go!
What do I say when I catch him? This is what spies do. They improvise. You'll think of something. I have to go.
I broke the connection.
Where were all the pens? How could Scott have a desk with no pens, no pencils?
Finally, I found one in my bag and scribbled a quick note on the scrap of paper. I slid the paper under the hot dog. Outside, I heard the Mustang roar into the complex's parking lot. I crossed to the closet and climbed up a second time. I was stretched on my tiptoes, stabbing at the box with the hanger. The front door slammed.
"Scott," I heard Mrs. Parnell say from the kitchen, "what are you doing back so soon?"
I got the hook part of the hanger under the lip of the lid and coaxed it out of the compartment. Once I had it halfway out, gravity did the rest. The box dropped into my hands. I'd just shoved it inside my bag and one-armed the chair back to its place at the desk when the bedroom door smacked open. Scott's eyes found me in an instant.
"What are you doing?" he demanded.
"I wasn't expecting you to come back so fast," I stammered.
"The audition was fake, wasn't it?"
"I..."
"You wanted me out of the apartment."
He crossed to me in 2 steps and took my arm, giving me a rough shake.
"You made a big mistake coming here."
Mrs. Parnell moved into the doorway.
"What's the matter, Scott? For heaven's sake, let her go. She came by to pick up the sheet music you forgot." "She's lying. I didn't forget any sheet music."
Mrs. Parnell looked at me.
"Is that true?"
"I lied," I confessed shakily. I swallowed, trying to inject a measure of calm into my voice. "The thing is, I really wanted to ask Scott to the summer solstice party at Delphic, but I couldn't bring myself to do it in person. This is really awkward." I walked to the desk and offered him the hot dog along with the scrap of paper I'd scribbled the note on.
"Don't be a wiener," Scott read. "Go to summer solstice with me."
"Well, what do you think?"
I tried to hold a smile. "Do you want to be a wiener or not?"
Scott looked from the note to the hot dog to me.
"What?"
"Well, isn't that the cutest thing ever?" Mrs. Parnell chimed in. "You don't want to be a wiener, do you, Scott?"
"Give us a minute, Mom."
"Is summer solstice a dress-up party?" Mrs. Parnell asked.
"Like a dance? I could make a reservation at Todd's Tux's." "Mom."
"Oh, right. I'll just be in the kitchen. Nora, I've got to hand it to you. I had no idea you were up here planting an invite to the party. I really thought you were picking up sheet music. Very clever."
She winked, then backed out, pulling the door shut behind her.
I was left alone with Scott, and all my relief scattered.
"What are you really doing here?"
Scott repeated, his voice significantly darker.
"I told you." "Not buying it."
His eyes flicked beyond me, surveying the room.
"What did you touch?"
"I came by to give you the hot dog, I swear. I looked in the desk for a pen to write the wiener note, but that's it." Scott strode to the desk, pulled out each drawer, and sifted through the contents.
"I know you're lying."
I backed toward the door. "You know what? Keep the hot dog, but forget about summer solstice. I was just trying to be nice. I was trying to make up for the other night because I felt responsible for your face getting smashed. Forget I said anything." He assessed me in silence. I had no idea if he'd bought my act, but I didn't care. The only thought running through my mind was of getting out.
"I've got my eye on you," he said at last,
in a tone I found to be startlingly threatening. I'd never seen Scott so icily hostile.
"Think about that. Every time you think you're alone, think again. I'm watching you. If I ever catch you in my room again, you're dead. We all clear?"
I swallowed. "Crystal." On my way out, I passed Mrs. Parnell standing near the fireplace drinking a glass of iced tea. She took a swig, set the glass on the mantel, and flagged me down.
"Scott is quite the boy, isn't he?"
she said. That's one way of putting it. I bet you asked him to the party early because you knew all the other girls would race to get in line if you didn't act fast. Summer solstice was tomorrow night, and everyone going already had dates. Unable to tell this to Mrs. Parnell, I opted for a smile. She could interpret it however she wanted. "Do I need to get him fitted for a tux?" she asked. "Actually, the party is really casual. Jeans and a shirt are fine." I'd let Scott break the news to her that we were no longer going together. Her face fell slightly. "Well, there's always homecoming. I don't suppose you're planning to ask him to homecoming." "I really haven't thought about it yet. And anyway, Scott might not want to go with me."
"Don't be silly. You and Scott go way back. He is crazy about you."
"Or crazy, period."
"I have to go, Mrs. Parnell. It was great seeing you again."
"Drive safely,"
she called, giving me a finger wave. I met V outside in the parking lot. She was hunched over, fists pressed into her knees, sucking air. A splotch of sweat stained the back of her shirt. "Nice decoy work," I said. She looked up, her face pink as a Christmas ham.
"You ever try chasing down a car?" she gasped.
"I'll one-up you. I gave Scott my hot dog and asked if he'd go to summer solstice with me."
"What does the hot dog have to do with anything?"
"I said he'd be a wiener if he didn't go with me." V wheezed laughter. "I'd have run harder had I known I'd get to see you call him a wiener." 45 minutes later, V's dad had called AAA and had the Neon towed back onto the road and dropped me off in front of the farmhouse. I didn't waste any time clearing off the kitchen table and shaking Scott's shoebox out of my handbag. Multiple layers of duct tape were wrapped around the box, nearly a quarter of an inch thick. Whatever Scott was hiding, he didn't want the rest of the world finding it. I sawed through the tape with a steak knife. I freed the lid, set it aside, and peered into the box. A plain white tube sock lay innocently at the bottom. I stared at the sock, feeling my heart drop with disappointment. Then I frowned. I stretched the sock open just wide enough to look inside. My knees went soft. Inside was a ring. One of the Black Hand's rings. Chapter 19. I stared at the ring blankly. I could hardly contain my thoughts. Two rings? I didn't know what it meant. Clearly the Black Hand had more than one ring, but why did Scott have one? And why had he gone to the trouble of hiding it in a secret compartment in his wall? And why, if he was so ashamed of the branding on his chest, was he holding onto the ring that presumably had given it to him? In my bedroom, I dug my cello out of the closet and stowed Scott's ring in the zippered music pouch, right next to its twin, the ring I'd received by envelope last week. I didn't know how to make sense of it. I'd gone to Scott's looking for answers and was left feeling more confused than ever. I would have dwelt on the rings longer, maybe pieced together a few theories, but I was at a complete and utter loss. When the grandfather clock chimed midnight, I double-checked the door locks one last time and crawled into bed. I propped my pillows up, sat upright, and painted my fingernails midnight blue. After my fingernails, I moved on to my toenails. I turned on my iPod. I read several chapters in my chemistry text. I knew I couldn't go forever without sleep, but I was determined to put it off as long as possible. I was terrified Patch would be waiting for me on the other side if I did. I hadn't realized I'd fallen asleep until I woke to a strange scraping sound. I lay in bed, frozen, straining to hear the sound again and place it. The drapes were drawn, the room shadowy. I slipped out of bed and dared a look through the drapes. The backyard was still, undisturbed, deceptively peaceful. A low creak sounded downstairs. I grabbed my cell phone off the nightstand and opened my bedroom door just wide enough to peer out. The hall outside was clear, and I turned into it, my heart beating so hard against my ribs I thought my chest might crack. I'd made it to the top of the stairs when the softest click alerted me that the knob on the front door was turning. The door opened, and a figure stepped cautiously into the dark foyer. Scott was in my house, standing 15 feet away at the base of the stairs. I steadied my grip on the cell phone, which was slick with sweat. "What are you doing here?" I called down to Scott. He jerked his head up, startled. He raised his hands level with his shoulders, showing he was harmless.
"We need to talk."
"The door was locked. How did you get in?"
My voice was high, shaky. He didn't answer, but he didn't need to. Scott was Nephilim, freakishly strong. I was almost positive that if I'd walked down to check the deadbolt, I would have found it damaged by the sheer strength of his hands.
"Breaking and entering is illegal," I said.
"So's theft. You stole something that belongs to me."
I moistened my lips. "You have one of the Black Hand's rings."
"It's not mine. I stole it."
His slight hesitation told me he was lying.
"Give me the ring back, Nora."
"Not until you tell me everything."
"We can do this the hard way if you want."
He climbed the first step.
"Don't move,"
I ordered, scrambling to dial 911 on my cell. "If you come another step, I'll call the police."
"It will take the police 20 minutes to get out here."
"That's not true." But we both knew it was. He advanced to the second step.
"Stop," I ordered. "I'll place the call, I swear I will." "And tell them what? That you broke into my room? That you stole valuable jewelry?"
"Your mom let me inside," I said nervously.
"She wouldn't have if she'd known you were going to steal from me."
He took another step, the stairs creaking under his weight. I racked my brain for a way to divert him from climbing higher. At the same time, I wanted to goad him into telling me the truth once and for all. "You lied to me about the Black Hand. That night in your bedroom? Wow, quite an act. The tears were almost convincing." I could see his mind spinning, trying to figure out how much I knew.
"I did lie," he said at last. "I was trying to keep you out of the middle of things. You don't want to get mixed up with the Black Hand."
"Too late. He killed my dad."
"Your dad isn't the only one the Black Hand wants dead. He wants me dead, Nora. I need the ring."
Suddenly he was on the fifth step. "Dead? The Black Hand couldn't kill Scott. He was immortal. Did Scott think I didn't know? And why was he so intent on getting the ring back? I thought he despised his branding." A new piece of information rose to the surface of my mind. "The Black Hand didn't force you to get the branding mark, did he?" I said. "You wanted it. You wanted to join the society. You wanted to swear allegiance. That's why you kept the ring. It's a sacred token, isn't it? Did the Black Hand give it to you after he finished branding you?"
His hand flexed around the banister. "No, I was forced."
"I don't believe you."
His eyes narrowed. "Do you think I'd let some psychopath grind a burning hot ring into my chest? If I'm so proud of the branding, why am I always covering it up?"
"Because it's a secret society. I'm sure you thought a branding was a small price to pay for the benefits that come with being part of a powerful society."
"Benefits? You think the Black Hand has done a single thing for me?"
His tone was cut with anger.
"He's the Grim Reaper. I can't escape him, and trust me, I've tried. More times than I can count."
I absorbed this, catching Scott in another lie. "He came back," I said, speaking my thoughts aloud. "After he branded you. You lied when you said you never saw him again."
"Of course he came back," Scott snapped. "He'd call late at night or sneak up on me on my way home from work wearing a ski mask. He was always there."
"What did he want?" His eyes gauged me.
"If I talk, will you give the ring back?"
"Depends if I think you're telling the truth." Scott scrubbed his knuckles furiously over his head.
"The first time I saw him was on my 14th birthday. He said I wasn't human. He said I was Nephilim like him. He said I had to join this group he belonged to. He said all Nephilim had to band together. He said there was no other way we could free ourselves from the fallen angels."
Scott glared up the stairs at me, defiant, but his eyes held a shadow of wariness, as if he thought I might think he was crazy.
"I thought he'd lost it. I thought he was hallucinating. I kept dodging him, but he kept coming back. He started threatening me. He said the fallen angels would get me once I turned 16. He'd follow me around after school and work. He said he was watching my back, and I should be grateful. Then he found out about my gambling debts. He paid them off, thinking I'd see it as a favor and want to join his group. He didn't get it. I wanted him to go away. When I told him I was going to get my dad to slap a restraining order on him, he hauled me into the warehouse, tied me down, and branded me. He said it was the only way he could keep me safe. He said that someday I'd understand, and I'd thank him."
The tone of Scott's voice told me that day was never going to come. "Sounds like he's obsessed with you."
Scott shook his head. "He thinks I betrayed him. My mom and I moved here to get away from him. She doesn't know about the Nephilim stuff or the branding. She just thinks he's a stalker. We moved, but he doesn't want me running off,
and he especially doesn't want to risk having me open my mouth and blow the cover on his secret cult.
Does he know you're in Coldwater?
I don't know. That's why I need the ring. When he finished branding me, he gave me the ring. He said I had to keep it and find other members to recruit. He told me not to lose it. He said something bad would happen if I did.
Scott's voice shook slightly.
He's crazy, Nora. He could do all kinds of things to me.
You have to help me find him.
He advanced two more steps. Forget it. I'm not going looking for him.
He reached his hand out.
Now give me the ring. Stop stalling. I know it's here.
For no reason other than instinct, I turned and ran. I slammed the bathroom door shut behind me and punched the lock.
This is getting old, Scott said through the door. Open up.
He waited.
You think this door is going to stop me?
I didn't, but I didn't know what else to do. I was pressed against the back wall of the bathroom, and that was when I saw the paring knife on the counter. I kept it in the bathroom to open cosmetic packages and to easily remove tags from my clothes. I picked it up, pointing the blade out. Scott rammed his body against the door, and it banged open, slamming back against the wall. We were standing face to face, and I leveled the knife at him. Scott walked up to me, yanked the knife out of my hand, and redirected it at me.
Who's in charge now? He sneered.
The hallway behind Scott was dark, light from the bathroom illuminating the faded flower wallpaper in the hall. The shadow moved so stealthily across the wallpaper, I almost missed it. Rickson appeared behind Scott, holding the base of the brass lamp my mom kept on the entryway table. He brought the lamp down on Scott's skull in a crushing blow.
Oof!
Scott blubbered, staggering around to see what had hit him. In what looked like a jerk of reflex, he yanked the knife up and sliced blindly. The knife missed, and Rickson slammed the lamp down on Scott's arm, causing him to drop the knife at the same moment that he collapsed sideways into the wall. Rickson kicked the knife down the hall, out of reach. He rammed his fist into Scott's face. A spray of blood flecked the wall. Rickson threw a second punch, and Scott's back dragged down the wall until he sat slumped on the floor. Gripping Scott's collar, Rickson uprighted him long enough to deliver a third punch. Scott's eyes rolled back in his head.
Rickson!
I jerked away from the violence at the sound of V's hysterical voice. She hiked up the stairs using the banister to pull herself faster.
Stop, Rickson! You're going to kill him!
Rickson let go of Scott's collar and stepped away.
Patch would kill me if I didn't.
He turned his attention to me.
You okay?
Scott's face was splattered with blood and it made my stomach roll. I'm fine, I said numbly.
You sure? You need something to drink. A blanket. You want to lie down?
I looked between Rickson and V. What are we going to do now?
I'm going to call Patch,
Rickson said, flipping his cell open and pressing it to his ear. He's going to want to be here for this. I was too much in shock to argue otherwise.
We should call the cops,
V said. She stole a brief look at Scott's unconscious and battered body. Should we tie him up? What if he wakes up and tries to get away?
I'll tie him in the back of the truck as soon as I finish this call,
Rickson said.
Come here, babe,
said V, pulling me into her arms. She guided me down the stairs, her arm curled around my shoulder.
Are you okay?
Yes, I answered automatically, still in a daze.
How did you guys get here?
Rickson came over, and we were hanging out in my bedroom when I got one of those creepy feelings that we should check on you. When we pulled up, Scott's Mustang was parked in the driveway. I figured his being here couldn't be good, especially since we'd been snooping around in his bedroom. I told Rickson something was wrong, and he told me to wait in the car while he went in. I'm just glad we made it before something worse happened. Holy freak show! What was he thinking, pulling a knife on you? Before I could tell her I'd pulled the knife first, Rickson jogged downstairs, joining us in the foyer.
I left a message for Patch, he said. He should be here soon. I also called the cops.
20 minutes later, Detective Basso braked at the bottom of the driveway, a Kojak light flashing on the roof of his car. Scott was slowly regaining consciousness, stirring and groaning in the bed of Rickson's truck. His face was a swollen, blotchy mess, and his hands were roped at his lower back. Detective Basso hauled him out and swapped the rope for handcuffs.
I didn't do anything, Scott protested, his lip a blubbery mess of blood and tissue. Breaking and entering is nothing, Detective Basso echoed. Funny, the law disagrees. She stole something from me. Scott jerked his chin in my direction. Ask her. She was in my bedroom earlier tonight. What did she steal? I can't talk about it.
Detective Basso looked to me for confirmation.
She's been with us all night, V inserted quickly. Right, Rickson?
Absolutely, Rickson said.
Scott nailed me with a look of betrayal. Not so goody-two-shoes now, are you?
Detective Basso ignored him.
Let's talk about this knife you pulled. She pulled it first.
You broke into my house, I said. Self-defense.
I want a lawyer, Scott said.
Detective Basso smiled, but there was no patience in it.
A lawyer? You sound guilty, Scott. Why'd you try to knife her?
I didn't try to knife her. I took the knife out of her hand. She was the one trying to knife me.
He's a good liar. I'll give him that, Rickson said.
You're under arrest, Scott Parnell, Detective Basso said,
ducking Scott's head as he directed him into the back seat of the patrol car.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you.
Scott kept his expression hostile, but beneath all the cuts and bruises, he seemed to pale.
You're making a big mistake, he said,
only he was looking right at me.
If I go to jail, I'm like a rat in a cage. He'll find me and kill me. The Black Hand will.
He sounded genuinely terrified, and I was torn between silently congratulating him on a well-delivered act and thinking maybe he really had no idea what he was capable of as Nephilim. But how could he be branded into a Nephilim blood society and have no clue that he was immortal? How could the society have failed to mention that? Scott didn't move his eyes from mine. Adopting a pleading tone, he said,
"This is it, Nora. If I leave here, I'm dead."
"Yeah, yeah," Detective Basso said, shutting the door hard. He turned to me. "Think you could stay out of trouble the rest of the night?"
Chapter 20. I raised my bedroom window and sat on the ledge, thinking. A refreshing breeze and a night chorus of insects kept me company. At the far end of the field, a light blinked on in one of the houses. It felt strangely reassuring to know I wasn't the only person still awake at this hour. After Detective Basso had driven away with Scott, V and Rickson had examined the lock on the front door.
"Whoa," V had said, staring at the mangled door. "How did Scott get the deadbolt to bend like that? A blowtorch?"
Rickson and I had merely looked at each other.
"I'll stop by tomorrow and install a new lock," he'd said.
That had been over 2 hours ago, and Rickson and V were long gone, leaving me alone with my own thoughts. I didn't want to think about Scott, but found my mind straying there anyway. Was he overreacting, or was I going to find out tomorrow that he'd been mysteriously roughed up while in police custody? Either way, he wouldn't die. A few bruises, maybe, but not death. I didn't allow myself to think the Black Hand might take it further than that, if the Black Hand was even a threat. Scott wasn't even sure the Black Hand knew he was in Coldwater. Instead, I told myself there was nothing I could do at this point. Scott had broken into my house and pointed a knife at me. He was behind bars because of himself. He was locked up, and I was safe. The irony was, I wished I could be at the jail tonight. If Scott was bait for the Black Hand, I wanted to be there to face the Black Hand once and for all. My concentration was dulled by the need for sleep, but I did my best to sort through the information I had. Scott was branded by the Black Hand, and the feel. Rickson said Patch was the Black Hand, an angel. It almost seemed like I was looking for two different individuals sharing the same name. The hour had stretched long past midnight, but I didn't want to sleep. Not when it meant opening myself up to Patch. Feeling his net close around me, seducing me with words and his silky touch, confusing me more than I already was. More than sleep, I wanted answers. I still hadn't been to Patch's apartment, and more than ever, I felt certain that was where the answers were. I tugged on dark wash matchstick jeans and a black fitted tee. Because the forecast called for rain, I opted for tennis shoes and my waterproof windbreaker. I took a taxi to the easternmost edge of Coldwater. The river shimmered like a wide, black snake. The outline of factory chimneys beyond the river played tricks in the night, making me think of hulking monsters if I looked at them from the corner of my vision. When I'd walked to the 500 block of the industrial district, I found two apartment buildings, both 3 stories high. I let myself into the lobby of the first building. All was quiet, and I assumed the tenants were tucked in their beds. I checked the mailboxes in the back, but there was no listing for Cipriano. Not that Patch would be careless enough to leave his name behind.
if he really was going to great lengths to keep his place off the radar. I climbed the stairs to the top, apartments 3A, B, and C, no apartment 34. I jogged down the steps, walked a half block down, and tried the second building. Behind the main doors sat a cramped lobby with scuffed tiles and a thin coat of paint barely masking red and black graffiti.